Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Today is Tuesday, November 28th, 2023 at 9:02 a.m. We're all here for the regular meeting of the Annuity and Pension Board Employee Retirement System for the City of Milwaukee. Can I have a roll call, please?
Yes, Ms. Ford?
Here.
Mr. Helling?
Here.
Ms. King? Not present as yet. Mr. Klusman?
Here.
Mr. Conrad?
Here.
Mr. Kovac? Mr.
Here.
Okay, thanks. Ms. Sawa?
Here.
Mr. Bell?
Here.
Quorum.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. We'll get started right away with the regular meeting today agenda. We're going to jump to item four, new business. Letter A, approval of new actuarial tables for pension benefits presented by Kavanaugh McDonald, and I believe Larry is here. Good morning, Larry. Go ahead.
Good morning, Matt. Hello, everyone. I think Terry's going to drag you here so fast. So we have here, and this seems like deja vu, it is. We talked about this back in the spring, and periodically the pension board adopts new factors, and these factors are used for the calculation of benefits. They're typically adopted after the experience study is adopted, and as we all know, that we went through that last year. And when we presented these amounts, you'll recall that we gave a suggestion that we could continue the current framework that's used for these factors, or we could potentially refine it a bit and split it up based upon the different groups within the system. Now, just give a broad perspective on factors, the joint survivor factors in the public sector. There's a fair amount of practice hanging out there with regard to how factors are applied within different retirement systems. I will tell you, some systems, typically small ones, don't even update them periodically with the experience study. Others might use factors that are consistent across the whole population. Some might have factors for every employment group or every type of tier within an employment group. So there is no one standard amount hanging out there, or standard practice, as it were. So the big changes with these factors that we gave was updating to the mortality rates to those PUB 210 family of mortality tables. So you recall, those are the first mortality tables that were constructed based upon public sector employees, which came out a couple of years ago. And also the reduction in the investment return assumption to the 7.5% that was used for the 2023 valuation. So if you can curve her down just a little bit, Terry, that'd be great.
No, on this subject.
So, we've done in the past just a little higher, just a little bit. Thank you. In the past, we had a single table of joint survivor factors for all groups. There are some variations between the groups that potentially could be implemented, multiple cost of living adjustments. We have different mortality tables for the first time with this experience study. And then male to female ratios vary from group to group to group. Now, I always have to caution, because there's a court case out there from the early 80s that says we can't use mortality for purposes of these factors. Said a better way, we can't charge different rates for a male versus a female who are in similar situations, same age, same provisions, all that. And we that's probably never been done over the past several decades, because that's been something that's been common in the public sector world for years. And we think, you know, the single table work, but we, in this letter, we outlined multiple tables, and I think at that point, it went to legal for review. And that's why we're back now for this discussion a few months later. I think the next page doesn't... this page talks about the different schedules that we made use of or suggested. And again, I want to say suggested, recommended is a strong word, because there's a lot of different ways of going about this. And we're not wed to one particular method over the other. I think a little bit lower, Terry, thanks. I appreciate you driving this. And then we had the calculations of the, what the differences would be, which I know we've all gone over. I'd be happy to go over it again, but I think with that, no decision has been made in terms of whether or not we're going to maintain the current one table framework or this multiple table framework. Probably now would be a good time for other folks to chime in on this.
Patrick, did you have any comments?
Thank you, Larry.
Any comment for Larry?
Go ahead.
So the current table is off the board, right? We're just either taking the combined table or the separate table. Looking at that last page.
Yeah, could you go to the last page? When you say the current table, you mean the one that's in place now being used for benefits?
Right, that we're not going to use that anymore?
Yeah, that, I mean, where the practice has been, and I think of it as a good practice, that whenever the assumptions are updated as a result of an experience study, we update the table. So we can either go from, I love the colors in this chart too. The current table is, I like your wording, is off the table. System has had a history of updating these factors after new assumptions are available. And so we're either looking at the combined table, which is our vernacular for keeping the same structure of one table applied to all, or separate tables. Where we would expand the tables and we'd pick the table based upon whether the person's general, the fire, police, things of that nature. Did that answer, Tim?
Yes, that definitely answered.
Cool. And when you're looking at these factors, you might step back and say, oh goodness, I mean, it does result in somewhat lower benefits, right? And that's been a trend that we've been seeing in factors of this nature. And the primary driver of that, there's two offsetting factors. I mean, these things are only based upon mortality, investment return, and a COLA. Well, improved mortality actually would result in an increase in these factors. But a slight increase. It's the drop in the discount rate, the drop in the investment return assumption from the 8.25% that was used before to the 7.5% that was recommended and adopted as part of the experience study. So
if we would adopt this or take one of these tables, is there still like that 90-day window where people would still be on that current table?
I'm going to defer to Jerry, I think, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Helling, this is Jerry. That's what we had communicated to the members, and as a practical matter, it would take us some time to load up the factors anyway, but I believe our current position on this is that we would implement these April 1st so that people would have time to become aware of the change and decide if they wanted to go out under the old factors or the new factors.
Okay, yeah, it sounds like plenty of time then.
Mr. Chair, Plusman has a question.
Thank you, Tim, and Jerry, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, Larry, maybe it's not to you because it's maybe more of a legal question, but you brought up the standard that kind of jumped in my, hit my mind, is that you said there was some court decision on the legality of, you know, applying different rates based on sex. So understanding that, aren't we kind of getting into dangerous territory here when you just told us also that you know that these pools that we're looking to carve up are disproportionate based on sex, and possibly that could be driving this differential, and thereby we're treading into some dangerous water on that precedent? Did I make sense there?
Yeah, no, that's a nice question. I never really consider my profession to be dangerous, but I appreciate you making it sound very, very dangerous. So the sex thing, I'm going to refer to it as gender. You know, that's rather specific, and it gets to whether you, it gets to the point that court case said that you can't charge different rates just because of gender. You know, so you might have someone who's age 60, and, you know, if you have two people age 60 and one's a male and one's a female, you have to charge them the same rate. Now, this stuff that we discussed with regard to the proportion of the population that's male versus female, it's okay for us to make use of that for purposes of developing the joint survivor factors.
And it's Larry, can I just add to that real quick, if you don't mind?
Yeah.
This is Aaron Shohan. So what we're talking about doing here is blending mortality rates to come up with a unisex mortality assumption for the three different groups. And so when Larry was referring to the male-female makeup of the different groups and how it differs between each group, that really goes into affecting the blending that then comes up with the unisex mortality, so that we're not charging, or quote-unquote charging, members a different amount based on their sex. It is based on their, it would be their employment classification, if that makes sense.
I get it, but I guess I'm a little hesitant, because your explanation takes a very narrow look. You're applying the exacting standards of this decision when, where I'm looking at it as the legal field is constantly evolving, and we have tens of thousands of attorneys out there prying open every case, and they tend to do it based on the parameters of a decision to expand it into their case, which, you know, keeps them all in business. And if it sounds to me a lot like the standards here are not very far. I mean, again, that's why I asked, maybe Patrick could weigh in or something, because it doesn't seem like that difficult of a case to make, because we just recognized openly in an open meeting that we know that these are disproportionately weighted groups based on set on gender. And now if we take this action, which is a new action, and we're deviating from our historical past, and it's going to impact certain sex in disproportionately, it seems like a dangerous, and that also may be filtering into the math that, and I'm sure part of the court decision on this is, you know, ignore the data on the difference between the gender mortality, and you cannot charge them differently, because we all know that there is a difference in gender mortality, but the court's requiring us to ignore that and charge the same, which seems to be the opposite of what we're doing here. They're proposing to do or considering to do here.
Sure, and Patrick would certainly have, you know, the legal expertise to address that. I will simply say that reflecting the demographic makeup of a group when we're calculating actuarial equivalence factors for any client is very common practice. So,
I don't want to revisit this shortly when we get another, you know, suit letter because, you know, somebody's challenging it when we just then regret and say, why do we get ourselves into this mess? And, you know, when we had a good thing going. And like Larry kind of said earlier, that we're already ahead of the curve by revisiting this every 5 years. And now it seems like we're doubling down more so than other plans and really getting into the weeds. And then when that legal issue came up, I was indifferent toward this prior to today's meeting, kind of, but that gives me pause. But I'd like to hear from Patrick. Is he here today?
Good morning, everyone. Mr. Chair, it's Assistant City Attorney Pat McLean.
Oh, good.
Morning, Pat. Go ahead.
What a great segue. I can address the gender issue briefly and then discuss the initial legal concerns that sort of prompted the opinion, which, as I'm sure everyone here has noticed, is not before everyone, but has been signed, and just due to administrative delay, we weren't able to get it out to you before the meeting. So the legal conclusions have been made, and I will follow up with a hard copy of the opinion after the meeting, but I'll lay out sort of the wave top conclusions that we've reached so the board can make an informed decision. Just looking at the gender issue, this was not one of the specifically identified issues that we were requested to examine, but just, you know, based off of what I've heard, you know, there's a difference between treating individuals differently solely based on their gender and using gender as one component of making a demographic assumptions about a larger group. So I think that, and I haven't reviewed the case that Larry referred to, but I would imagine that it was something similar to that, that there was individual treatment of females solely because they were females versus using gender as one component in determining an accurate rate of mortality for a larger demographic group. So I will certainly follow up on that and do a deeper dive into it, but I think that there's a significant legal distinction between those two things. And especially if it's a common actuarial practice, I would imagine that if there is a legal issue with it, that there's going to be quite a bit of case law about it, because as you've said, people are litigious, and especially on something like that. I regret that I don't have more, but I'd certainly be able to delve to talk about it a little bit more if anyone has any specific questions about the gender issue. Okay, not hearing any. I'll just jump right into the opinion. And again, I apologize for not having a hard copy in front of you. It is complete. The city attorney has reviewed it, and we will be issuing it, I suspect, later today. But basically, the opinion makes three overall conclusions. The first is which Chapter 36 grants the board exclusive authority over the adoption of actuarial tables. As this board knows, because it exercised this authority earlier this year, the board is required at least once every 5 years to adopt new mortality tables based on, or taking into account, is the language that Chapter 36 uses, the result of the five-year experience study and the valuation. So that's the only express restriction on the adoption of tables, is that the board take into account the five-year experience study and the valuation, and the board's recent adoption of the new tables certainly complied with those requirements. And the adopting the new table of factors would be no different. So that's the first conclusion, is that the board has exclusive administrative authority over this subject matter. The second conclusion is that the adoption of what I will just refer to in the shorthand as multiple tables would not violate any sort of concept of equity. Equity was one of the specific factors we were asked to address. And within the pension context, the concept of equity is reflected in what's called the duty of impartiality. As I'm sure the board will recall from the excellent fiduciary training that they received earlier this year, the duty of impartiality requires a trustee to not treat any individual beneficiary more or a group of beneficiaries more favorable than another. The duty of impartiality is not the same as exact equal treatment. The law recognizes that pension plans or various types of trusts will frequently create interests that come into conflict over time. So the duty simply requires the trustee to give due regard to the diverse interests created by the trust document and come up with a solution that reasonably balances those interests. Applying this concept to the use of multiple tables, it's our conclusion that no violation of the duty of impartiality would result from adopting multiple tables. As Larry's letter lays out, adopting the tables would result in different impacts for different employee groups. However, as we understand it, these tables generally more accurately reflect the demographic data of these individual groups. So to the extent that the implementation of these tables would produce different results for different groups, those differences would reflect the amelioration of a past imbalance created by the use of blended tables rather than creating a current imbalance based on some lower level of accuracy. So in sum, our second conclusion was that the board may adopt the dual tables without violating their duty of impartiality. And then finally, the third consideration we were asked to review is collective bargaining issues. To sum it up, the collective bargaining agreements maintained by the city effectively prohibit the unilateral modification of any pension benefit. And pension benefits are defined as those benefits that exist as a result of Chapter 36. If you look at the survivorship benefits, which is obviously what these tables are most applicable to, the benefit is required to be, a survivorship benefit is required to be reduced to the actuarial equivalence of a beneficiary's normal service retirement benefit. And actuarial equivalence is defined in Chapter 36 as a benefit of equivalent value as determined on the basis of the tables most recently adopted by the board. So the benefits protected by collective bargaining agreement do not guarantee the use of any specific actuarial table other than that, quote unquote, most recently adopted by the board. And as I mentioned a moment ago, the board is required to periodically adopt new tables every 5 years. So the survivorship benefit takes into account the fact that these tables will change over time. So in sum, our conclusion is that there are no collective bargaining considerations that would prohibit the board from adopting multiple tables. I'll additionally note that this is consistent with state law. Numerous Wisconsin court cases have repeatedly held that pension beneficiaries do not have a right to the administration of the pension trust. And so we are confident that the adoption of actuarial tables, including tables of factors, is a matter of plan administration and not a benefit that is somehow impaired by periodically adopting new tables. I'll just also finally note that the collective bargaining agreements I want to say tacitly, but it's really expressly recognize this distinction. For example, in the Milwaukee Police Association collective bargaining agreement, there's a provision that states that any pension matter under the exclusive jurisdiction or control of any duly constituted pension board cannot constitute a grievance under the contract. So that's just sort of further reinforcement of the distinction between administration and benefits within the context of collective bargaining rights. So to roll that all up, based on the three conclusions that I've just highlighted, we believe that the board can consistent with its authority granted under Chapter 36 and its fiduciary obligations, choose to adopt the dual tables that are, or the multiple tables, excuse me, that are currently being presented, and it is a matter of discretion for the board. I'd be happy to expound on any of that or answer any questions anyone has.
Thank you, Patrick. Any comments or questions from board members? For Patrick, not hearing any.
Mr. Chairman. I guess I have a question. In making this decision, what standard are we supposed to use? Are we supposed to make the decision slightly more favorable to the members?
Yes, as always, as trustees, the board is required to make its decisions in the best interests of the members. In this case, obviously, that duty of impartiality is implicated. There are competing interests here among various employee groups, and the standard that is required under the duty of impartiality is that the board must give due regard to those diverse interests and make a decision that reasonably balances those interests consistent with the plan document. I will say that the opinion does mention that because the new tables are more accurate per each employee group, that they do appear to uphold the duty of impartiality with somewhat more accuracy than blended tables. However, the actuary has indicated that both in the letter that we went over previously, that both the multiple tables and the old blended tables would meet the definition of actuarial equivalence. So the board does have discretion to adopt either table, but must articulate a basis for choosing either one.
Mr. Chairman?
That's a really good question, Mr. Conrad. Go ahead.
Another question for Mr. Allen. Are there any particular administrative technical difficulties in adopting a combined table as opposed to a separate table?
There is more administrative complexity in having separate tables. So there is a sort of a normal dichotomy here. Separate tables would mean more administrative complexity than a single table. A single table, as Mr. McLean just mentioned, might be more accurate with respect to the benefit structures of the different employment classifications. And Larry, just to follow up on that last point, I'm assuming the reason that you've identified separate employment classifications is because there's a difference in the benefit structure. Is that correct, or is there some other reason that you haven't mentioned?
Yeah, Mayor will mop this up, but there's a difference in the, part of its difference in COLAs. But the primary reason we brought it up is because it's the first time, it's the difference in the mortality tables as well.
Yeah, so it's kind of, it's the three parts outlined in the letter.
Fire.
The benefit.
But yes, yeah, structure and.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Okay. It's the three parts. It would be the benefit structure that Larry mentioned. It would
be. You're up. You're good.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So the benefit structure, the distinct mortality assumptions, and then the differences in demographics. All three of those factors would play into the calculation of actual equivalent factors.
But to circle back to your question, Rudy, there is more administrative complexity in administering two sets of tables.
Mr. Chair, Pat McLean again.
Go ahead, Patrick.
I just wanted to clarify it. I may have heard, misheard Mr. Allen, or he may have misspoken, but the opinion concludes that the multiple tables, not the blended table, more accurately reflect the demographic assumptions for individual employee groups, and therefore more accurately reflects the demographic realities and benefit realities of each employee group. So to the extent that there's a difference between the multiple tables and the blended tables gave a slight benefit to the protective service groups just based on their demographics and benefit structure compared to the proposed multiple tables, which sort of bring it more back to a more accurate baseline for each employee groups and ameliorate that slight advantage. So I just wanted to make that clear. It's possible I misheard Mr. Land, but I wanted to just make it clear.
Well, thanks for clarifying, Patrick. But again, Rudy, there is more complexity if we have multiple tables. No question about that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks, Jerry. Any other comments or questions from board members? Not hearing any, I will entertain a motion regarding this issue. I guess I just want to second what Tom said about it was somewhat indifferent before this conversation and was looking forward to the discussion, which I think brought up some new thoughts on my part. I appreciate, Patrick, your work. We all know that it's important what you guys do at the city attorney's office and your recommendations. I don't think that really will prevent the litigation that Tom mentioned, is my first point. Second point, Tom's, or Mr. Conrad's question about what we keep in mind here is the employees, or when we're looking at decisions. And finally, for myself, I just wanted to address that I know that this, like Patrick just said, it does get a slight benefit to the protective services, which obviously I'm a part of. But just want to make it clear that I think if this was switched as well and the protective services were getting the advantage or the slight advantage or benefit, if roles were reversed, I'd be advocating for the same thing. Therefore, I am leaning towards keeping the combined tables.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Helen agrees with you and Tom as well, the combined table.
Thank you. Tim, any other comments or questions from board members or discussions? Right, not hearing any, I will put forward a motion to regarding this discussion, motion to approve the new actuary tables for pension benefits to be the combined table regarding survivorship. I have a motion regarding.
Mr. Helen will make that motion.
Thank you, Tim. Do I have a second?
Mr. Chair, before I hate to go backwards, and you can tell me no if you want to.
Oh, go ahead, Tom.
But I guess I had the question pop up, and because I didn't really take a position on it yet, because I was just asking those questions about that legal issue that popped up. And then Patrick's explanation obviously, like always, helps substantially. But maybe, Patrick, you could help me see through here. My initial reaction is that with all matters, we should, if we're going to shift gears and change direction, there should be some compelling need. And I don't think I heard that here, but I did hear that as time goes on, you know, we don't live in caves anymore and ride horses everywhere. Technology's advanced, and now we have the opportunity to be more accurate in what we're doing. And that's the basis for why we're entertaining this now. So there's not so much a compelling need, it's just that the advent of this new data has given us the opportunity to consider this as a more accurate way of doing our job. Am I summarizing that layperson wise correctly?
Yeah, I think that you are. I mean, anytime, and Larry alluded to this, anytime new factors are adopted, there's going to be some winners and losers. And I hate to use that terminology, but that's the truth. I mean, just based on your unique circumstances, whenever you're dealing with assumptions about a group, some people are going to benefit from it, and some people are not going to benefit from it. And when I say that, I mean, we're talking about relatively slight differences. You know, there would be some, if you review the letter, there are some larger increases. I think the NOCOLA general city group, I think that some of the increases were predicted to be as high as 5%. But generally, the effect here is plus or minus, you know, like 1 or 1.5%, give or take a few decimals. And so I think that you've accurately summarized it. It is a matter of board discretion. And as long as the board has a basis that is, you know, serves the benefit of the members, it can validly make either decision.
Okay, and then my last question is, as my fear of litigation oozes out some more, the point you talked about with our decision making and fiduciary duty to, you know, not advantage or disadvantage any particular group, even though we recognize that this is going to, like you just mentioned, do that, we're not considering it for reasons that are not accurate to the issue at hand. And I apologize for being so long-winded. We're not saying that, hey, you know, public safety employees have better benefits. Their pensions are higher than the average general city employee, or their COLA's better. So we should take this action to help, you know, in like some social design to equalize everyone. We're saying that based on this data, that's why we're looking at this action. Did that make sense, Patrick?
I'm not sure it did. Can you rephrase the question or the statement?
To your point about us having responsibility to all members and not to the fiduciary duty to not create an advantage or disadvantage to particular groups within our members. This proposal is not based on some kind of social engineering where we're saying that, you know, safe public safety employees have a richer retirement benefit, so therefore we should move around these other chips on the table to help equalize the others. We're looking at this and saying that this decision will be based on accurate data regarding, you know, the actuaries' tables.
Yeah, that did make sense. Yeah, I agree. You know, it's my understanding based on Larry's letter that the proposed multiple tables more accurately reflect the combined demographic data and benefit data of these individual groups. And it's because we're now that under the multiple tables, they would be broken out into individual groups that you see the benefit changes. But under the multiple tables, the calculations that result, whether they're higher or lower, more accurately reflect the particular factors affecting your specific group, whether you're a general city employee or protective service employee. The changes that you see in the multiple tables are all based on the fact that the data is now more tailored to these employees. And Larry, I don't even pretend to be an actuary on TV, so if I've misstated any of that, please feel free to jump in and correct me.
No, what you're saying is reasonable. If I hear something I don't agree with or doesn't comport with my professional opinion, I try to chime in through the chair. So everything's been sounding good so far. Thank you.
Yeah, a question for Mr. McLean. Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Rudy.
Yeah, Patrick, would it be correct to say, or argue perhaps, that we would best fulfill our obligation to the members in this context by choosing the most accurate table, because even for those who get a little less, that money would still go in the fund. It's accrued to everyone's benefit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to intrude on the board's discretion, but I will say that if you're going to look at this as a binary choice, you know, which lawsuit would you want to face? Would you want to face the lawsuit where everybody's benefit is calculated based on data that's tailored to their specific employee group? Or would you want to face the lawsuit where you are faced with employees whose benefits are decreased because of a larger blend? I think that, you know, to be clear, I think we could generate a reasonable legal arguments for either of those, but I certainly think that just the face value equities are more favorable in the group that just employs more accurate data. But again, I don't want to tip the scales. I think that there are reasonable arguments that can be made. I mean, most prominently, the fact that the actuary is certified that both of these would meet actuarial standards of practice. But if you're looking at it through the lens of the duty of impartiality, I think if you were going to balance the two, that I think it would militate in favor of the more accurate multiple tables.
Well, the lawsuit would stand or fall on if the judge decided this matter was in our discretion and go no further, then it would be successful on our side. If they get into the weeds, then it's a different, then that's guesswork as to what happens.
I agree.
Thank you, Rudy. Thank you, Patrick. I guess I'm leaning towards.
Mr. Chair?
Hi, Deborah. I just want to make sure procedurally we're okay. Just because that motion was brought up, I love the extra discussion we're having. So, Jerry, do I have to do anything to table that motion, or just at some point I know it has to be dealt with?
This is all just discussion.
Okay, great. No, awesome. Just want to make sure, because it was out there halfway, and I don't know exactly procedurally how to pull it back so we can continue to discuss. But go ahead, Ms. Ford.
No, thank you. As I've listened to the discussion, particularly this last round, it seems to me that this is not about social engineering or anything else. It just seems to me that tables that more accurately reflect the group seem to be more defensible than combined tables. And I'm sort of struggling to see why we wouldn't go with the additional tables as opposed to the combined tables. That piece is just not clear.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Deborah. And is that?
Molly. That's Molly.
Oh, hey, Molly. Good morning.
Good morning. Sorry, I was late to the meeting. I agree with Deborah. Based on what Patrick mentioned, you know, the impartiality and the more accurate is to vote on them, I believe the multiple table provide a more impartial or more accurate calculation for each group than combining it. I don't see the added benefit of combining. I understand maybe administratively that might make a whole lot of sense. But I don't understand why, I guess maybe this is for Larry, what are the benefits of us combining versus keeping it individual or the various multiple? Because I don't believe we're all the same, right? Whether you're, you know, the various table is obviously very different, or the calculation is very different apparently because of all things are not equal. So I'm not sure why we would consider combining, and I don't know what the truly know what the benefits are. And again, I joined the meeting a little late, so this is already discussed. My apologies.
So through the chair, Matt, the current structure is one combined table for all, and so the decision is: do we continue using the combined table, or do we split it into these multiple tables for all the, you know, reasons discussed? And, you know, again, you know, we develop factors like this for a lot of different plans, and we see both practices in place. Both, you know, a combined type of structure for all members, or, you know, a structure where it's you know, you get a little more granular. In the calculations, as would be under the proposed separate tables. I don't know if that answered or not, but
it does. It does actually kind of put things in perspective. And the only question, I think, Patrick, you mentioned earlier that some groups or some individuals, I can't remember the exact term you use, will benefit and some may not by a percentage or two. And a percentage two is not small, you know. If it's an incremental of a percentage is one thing, but what do you mean by that? Can you give an example of how that would play out?
Sorry to interrupt, but Terry, could you pull up your cool color chart?
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Perfect. Larry, do you want to field this one?
Yeah, I'll walk through it real quickly. I mean, we have a couple of examples. It's not exhaustive, but the examples that are prepared here, in this chart, and you can see the in the green and olive compared to the cornflower. Green and olive is for the general folks, and the cornflower is fire and police. We have for the general, if you go down and get about halfway through, and we talk about the survivor factors, and you can see those factors coming through: the 0.8603, the 0.8448, and 0.8583. are the three factors. Currently, we're charging 0.8603 this illustrative person, and under the combined factor table, we charge a little bit more. And, you know, briefly, the reason we charge a bit more here, I mean, why it's, we're charging more, is predominantly related to the drop in the discount rate. You know, it's going to happen pretty much regardless. And if we continue the combined factor for the general folks, you know, it's the benefit would go from $2,000 a month to $1,689.60. The separate table where we factor in the POLA provisions and the mortality of general and the same interest rate across all these. Instead of reducing the 168960, it goes to 171660. Now for fire and police, again, going from the current table to the current combined table, which is based upon the new assumptions, we still get a decrease from 493725 to 484971. The decrease is more if we go to the separate tables. And that's predominantly the COLA provisions that are driving that. The COLA provisions are a little bit more for police and fire, predominantly because they tend to retire a little bit earlier as well. You'll note in this that, you know, the retirement age we're using is 63 for general and, you know, 53 here for the police fire, and that sort of illustrates, you know, the typical retirement. And you can see it's a bit more of a reduction if we go to the separate tables for this particular instance. Did that walk through nicely?
It did. Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Is this Aicha.
Go ahead. I wanted to put in my two cents quickly, too. I think probably coming from the accountant auditor mentality as well, I'm always about the accuracy. So to me, it makes sense that if the separate is more accurate, that that would be the way to go. So that's just my two cents. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you, Aicha. Any other comments? I know Mr. Kovac, something I always, you know, really lean on, something mentioned by you maybe last year or so, but it's always great to get everybody's opinion and see if we can all get on the same page. But just wondering if you had any comments.
Sure, I'm happy to second the motion for the multiple tables.
I believe the motion was set for combined.
Oh, pardon me. That
was the first.
Never mind. I'd make a motion to accept the new, more accurate table as suggested by the actuary and the city attorney.
Got it. So we did not have a second on the first motion, and now Mr. Kovac has put together or put forward a motion to adopt the separate tables. Is that correct?
Yes.
Got it. So we have a first. Do we have a second regarding?
Skin will second that. Yeah, I'd like to second Mr. Kovac's motion and the actuary recommendation on multiple tables.
Okay, thank you, Ms. King. Do we have any objections regarding? Not hearing any objections, the motion to approve the separate tables for the survivorship passes. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Aaron. Any other comments or questions?
No, thank you much. Hope everyone has a great day.
Great. Thank you, Larry.
No, very much. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you, Aaron. All right, moving back to the beginning of the meeting, we'll do item number one, the approval of minutes, the regular meeting held October 24th, 2023. Any comments or questions from board members regarding the meeting minutes? Not hearing any. Do I have a motion to pass the regular meeting minutes for the meeting held October
24th, 2023?
Conrad moves approval. Thank you, Mr. Conrad. Do I have a second?
Molly, more seconds.
Thank you, Ms. Ford. Any objections? Not hearing any. Motion to approve the meeting minutes for October 24th, 2023 passes. Moving on to item two, Chief Investment Officer Report. Mr. Silber, are you going to handle this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sauer is prepared to provide the performance update to the board today, and then I'll just have some brief comments afterwards.
Great, thank you. Go ahead, Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. You can see that the fund ended the month of October with a value of $5.33 billion. the return of 1.9, negative 1.9% for the month, net of fees, underperformed the benchmark by approximately 7 basis points. The primary relative performance drivers were manager selection, real estate detracted 10 basis points, and Reams detracted 7 basis points. Within public equity, the style biases were a detractor. Value in small cap combined to detract approximately 16 basis points. Manager performance, on the other hand, was a bright spot. So 10 of 11 public equity mandates outperformed, and that added 21 basis points to our returns. You can see in the table to the right that the fund has underperformed the benchmark in the year-to-date and one-year periods, while outperforming in the 5, 10, 15, and 20-year periods. November, an update through November 27th, November has been a very nice month. We've seen a nice bounce back in both the stock and bond markets. So the fund return is up 4.4% month to date, which brings the year-to-date return to up 6.3% and the fund value to $5.57 billion. 10 out of the fund's 16 active mandates are outperforming year-to-date, and the fixed income and real assets asset classes are outperforming their respective benchmarks year-to-date. We've seen a change in the value investments of $350.1 million. Have paid out benefits and expenses of $406.8 million and have received contributions of $157.9 million. The fund's current cash balance is sufficient to cover the November benefit payments, so we will not need to make any manager withdrawals this month. That concludes my report. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them at this time.
Thank you, Eric. Before we get to David, any comments or questions from board members or staff? Or Eric? Not hearing any, we'll move on. Thank you again, Eric. Go ahead, David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Again, I'll be brief, but I mean, yeah, just kind of reiterating the point Eric made about, you know, how quickly things can change. Showing you the snapshots, 1.8% year to date, just as of the end of October. To be up over 4% just in November over these first few weeks and over 6% year to date. It's yeah, no, it's hate to get too high, but it certainly is exciting to now be within striking distance, to have a move of that magnitude and be within striking distance of that long term discount rate that we have. And I think it's also just another lesson for us that, you know, it's easy to be humbled by markets, and it's very difficult to time this stuff. So just a very, very quick move, and we'll hope that markets continue to cooperate between now and the end of the year. At least for the marks that we know are important for 12/31. Last thing I wanted to mention is that you're going to get an investment committee package at the end of this week for our meeting next Thursday. I don't think it's going to be a long meeting, but there will still be some important things on the agenda. I think we'll have three approval items. We'll have our Loomis sales follow-up. We may have a PE side letter and an investment policy statement update that'll be important to discuss. Callan's planning on coming in and giving their real estate performance update for our fund, which I think is always interesting, particularly with kind of the market environment for real estate right now. And we'll, of course, be prepared to give you another update on performance in a week and a half. That concludes my prepared remarks. I'm happy to take any questions if there are any.
David, this
thank
is,
you, Dave.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Rudy.
Yeah. David, if you flip the exhibit over on the return data, on absolute return.
Yes. Yeah, Terry, yeah, thank you.
It's at the bottom of that.
Mm-hmm.
on the floor. It's at the, I'm looking at the bottom right-hand corner, and there's another line.
Look, we, Terry, we can't see the return table on our screens. You need to go a little, either make the screen a little smaller or go scroll down a little bit more.
Yeah, scroll down, right.
A little bit more, Terry. We can't see the APSA return and 90-day T-bill return date on the bottom of that tab. Yeah, you have to go down further. Yeah.
I'm right at the bottom.
Yeah, we're not...
David, if is it being blocked by your mute and start? If you click on it, those will...
Yes, if you touch the screen, it'll go away.
Oh, okay, thank you. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Rudy.
Yeah, almost forgot my question, but if you look at the absolute return, keeping surprised at how well it does, even compared to the benchmark. But what accounts for that, if you remember, that three-year 13% return?
So that's, that. You know, for that number, you really have to look at the five-year and seven-year number for it to, with everything that happened in our APSA return portfolio with 2020 and 2021, 22, the volatility we had there, we basically had a negative number in 2020, and we had a positive number in 2022, I believe. So what's happening is that the three-year number's cutting off the COVID, first quarter of COVID. So it makes the three-year number look higher in the recovery. So really, if you focus on the five-year and the seven-year number, it's really reflective of how our absolute return is truly performed over the market cycles. So,
okay, well, thanks for the explanation, because I thought it was a bit curious. But the absolute return has been a pretty successful investment for us.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We're adding value in fixed income, but when you look at like the 5, 10, 15-year numbers, if you just focus on the benchmark, I mean, it basically tells you we're getting either flat returns or no more than, pretty much flat returns out of a bond index over 5 and 10 years. And an absolute return we're getting, whether we're outperforming our benchmark or not, I mean, we are over those longer time periods. I mean, to replace that fixed income return with a 6% annualized rate, 6.2% annualized return over 5 years and 5.6% a year over 7 years, it's been really, it played its role very well, and that's hard to do because that's alpha, that you can't invest in a low cost index and get those absolute return, net of fee returns that we've been able to generate. So. Yeah, no, your point, you're absolutely correct to point it out, because it's played its role. It's interesting. I mean, I'm kind of a nerd when it comes to this stuff, but it's when you look at investments, it's the past never predicts the future, right? So this was an environment where 10 years ago we were looking at artificially low interest rates, right? Because of what was going on at the Federal Reserve and things like that. So now you can get over, now we have bond managers that are getting yield to maturities of close to 6% now. So going forward, it's very possible that 10 years from now, I would hope that fixed income is going to look a lot better, and that's why we're increasing increased our allocation to it. But we were in a tough environment. When you were looking at bonds 5-10 years ago, it didn't look attractive, and that hedge fund, those hedge funds, in absolute return played their role. So.
Okay, thanks, David.
Thanks, Rudy. Thanks, David. Any other comments? I just have one quick one for you, David and Eric. I go back to what you said at a meeting a month ago about we'll see what the rest of the year holds and just how much the market has shifted in our favor. Just really hits home with me. And like you said, hopefully we continue to have this in the month of December and we can end on a high note. But I just went back to that comment you made and wanted to bring that up. So thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Any other comments before we move on? Not hearing any, we'll move on to item three, the investment committee report. We do have quite a few closed. Tom, do you want me to put us in closed and then you take over?
Do I have to give my report first?
I mean, just a point of clarification, Mr. Chairman. I mean, these are... We always put the closed session as a placeholder, but there's okay. there's no new information to provide. So, and I think we had, I mean, I don't think these were controversial items that were approved in closed session, but okay. I'm not sure if we had one or two potentially investment committee members that board members that may not have made the meeting. So If there's no desire to go into closed session, I mean, you can just approve the committee report and we don't have to do any of that. But if there's any committee member that would have comforts talking about one more time, what are we approving? What did we approve at the committee level? We have the ability to go into closed session the way we've structured on the agenda.
I feel fine with us not going into closed session based on our robust discussions we had in closed, but be willing to take any objections from any other board members that would like to continue a discussion. Anyone have that thought?
If Mr. Chair, Mr. Klusman?
Go ahead, Tom.
If it helps the other two that were at the committee, just so you know, we vetted this out pretty thoroughly, and it was the six of us were unanimous on our recommendations, if that helps you at all.
That sounds good to me, and the recollection I had as well was that it was a great discussion. So why don't, Tom, we just do your report, and we'll just approve the report, if everyone's comfortable with that, after it, and that will contain all the approvals for A, B, and C.
Great. Okay, then my report is at our November 9th meeting, Callum provided us a 2024 work plan to the committee. Staff shared its tentative 2024 due diligence schedule, and staff also went over the fund's third quarter performance report. In addition, staff and Callum led a discussion regarding the investment manager guideline changes that Luna Sales proposed at our September meeting. After some discussion, the committee approved the recommended changes with the exception of the 144A securities request, which will remain at the current 50%. The committee expects to receive further guidance from Callum regarding Luma Sales 144A securities request at our December meeting. The approved changes mainly pertain to the use of derivatives, credit default swaps, and individual bank loans in the portfolio, along with how the securities in the portfolio are rated. Finally, the committee went into closed session to go over the due diligence report and real estate manager side letter related to the real estate investment manager search that the committee conducted in April, and to discuss a recommendation regarding a real estate manager. The committee then went into open session to approve the real estate manager side letter and to approve the recommendation regarding the real estate manager. In all, the investment committee recommends approval of the following items: one, approval of the real estate manager side letter; two, approval of the recommendation regarding the real estate manager; and three, approval of the Luna Sales guidelines change. That's all I have.
Thank you, Tom. Any questions or comments from board members? Not hearing any. Does anyone have a motion to approve the investment committee report with the approval of A, real estate manager side letter; B, approval of recommendation regarding real estate manager; and C, approval of Luma Sales guideline change?
Mr. Holland will make that motion.
Thank you, Tim. Do I have a second?
Conrad seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Conrad. Any objections regarded? Not hearing any objections, the motion to approve the investment committee report passes. Thank you, Tom. We'll be to item number four. We handled letter A. Moving on to B, retirement death claims and refunds for October 2023. Go ahead, Jerry.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in your packet, we have the normal list of payments for our payroll this month, and we're just asking for a motion to approve the payroll, as Matt said, for retirements and death claims and refunds as well. So if we could have a motion, then you can vote on approving the payroll.
Thank you, Jerry. So I have a motion to approve payroll for October 2023. I will actually make the motion. Do I have a second?
4 seconds.
Thank you, Deborah. Any objections regarding this motion? Not hearing any objections, the motion to approve payroll for October 2023 passes. Letter C, we do have to go into closed sessions for this. For item C, proposed amendment of board rule, retirement and death benefits. Please be advised that the annuity and pension board may vote to convene in closed session on the following item. For letter C, as provided in section 19.85 sub 1 sub G Wisconsin state statutes, to confer with legal counsel concerning strategy to be adopted by the body with respect to litigation in which it is or is likely to become involved. The board may then vote to reconvene in open session following the closed session. Do I have a motion to go into closed?
Ms. King will make that motion.
Thank you, Ms. King. Do I have a second?
I only have a second.
Thank you, Tim. Any objections? Do I have a roll call, please, Jan?
Yes, Ms. Ford?
Aye.
Mr. Helling?
Aye.
Ms. King?
Aye.
Mr. Klusman?
Aye.
Mr. Conrad?
Aye.
Mr. Kovac?
Aye.
Ms. Sawa?
Aye.
Mr. Bell?
Aye. And the Quorum? Time is 10:15.
The recorder is paused.
10:44 a.m.
Thanks.
Give me a second here, please. Let me know when you're back. Thank you, Terry. We are back in open session. It's 10:45 a.m. and we are going to go back into closed session for item four, letter D. Please be advised that the Annuity and Pension Board may vote to convene in closed session on the following item, four, letter D, as provided in section 19.85 sub 1 sub E Wisconsin state statutes, to deliberate or negotiate the purchasing of public properties, the investing of public funds, or conducting other specified public business, whenever competitive bargaining reasons required a closed session. The board may then vote to reconvene in open session following the closed session. Do I have a motion to go into closed?
Plus one, a motion.
Second. Thank you, Tom. Do I have a second?
4 seconds.
Thank you, Ms. Ford. And can I please have a roll call, Jim?
Yes, Ms. Ford? Ms. Ford?
Aye.
Mr. Helling?
Aye.
Ms. King?
Aye.
Mr. Klusman?
Aye.
Mr. Conrad?
Aye.
Mr. Kovac?
Aye.
Ms. Sawa?
Aye.
Mr. Bell?
Aye.
Quorum. And say the time, please, and I'll pause the recorder.
Time is 10:46 a.m. Ready to go back into open session at 11:14 a.m.
Thank you, Terry. We are back in open session. It's 11:15 a.m. We completed item D. Just wanted to backtrack about a issue regarding item 4, letter B that came up regarding a disability question. Mr. Helling, did you have any further questions?
No, I got the issue clarified. Thanks.
Thank you, Tim. We will jump back to item 4, letter E, conference requests for November 2023 board meeting. We have one request. It's for a due diligence trip for Mr. Sauer and Mr. Courtright. It's to visit Castle Arc in Chicago, Illinois in January at $75 per person for estimated cost. Any comments or questions regarding from board members? Not hearing any, I'll make a motion to approve the conference request for the November 2023 board meeting. Do I have a second?
I'll leave a second.
Thank you, Tim. Any objections regarding? Not hearing any, the motion to approve the conference request for November 2023 meeting passes. Moving on to item 4, letter F, proposed 2024 board and committee meeting dates. In our packet, we have a list of the dates regarding the board meeting, the investment meetings, as well as the A&O committee meeting. Any comments or questions regarding those? The only concern I see is potentially July 23rd. I know that is at the conclusion of the RNC. I know that's going to be a strain on some of our resources. Does everyone feel comfortable keeping that board meeting at the 23rd? And if conflicts come up, we address it then. Not hearing any concern. Go ahead, Tom.
Do you want to just move it back a week to be safe with like the 29th? It seems kind of early in July, just to be.
That might be helpful just in case. I believe the RNC, I know the dates are restricted for public service through the 21st, I believe.
It's probably kind of helpful to make it as late in July as possible, also considering that we take the whole month of August off in case something comes in.
Yeah.
The double win. Jerry, what do you think?
That's a good suggestion.
So you would like to make it maybe the 29th or the 30th, Mr. Klusman?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If that works for staff.
Yeah, sure. Usually the later the better because it gives our members more opportunity to submit their papers of, you know, for retirement.
Yeah, good. And then any of us that want to go to the meeting physically, downtown's probably going to still be kind of getting put back together on the 23rd. Yeah.
My preference would be for a Tuesday, though. I mean, we do most of our meetings on Tuesdays. That's the 30th.
Okay.
I think that sounds good for myself. Matt, any objections regarding that? From anyone? Right, not hearing any. Can we make that change, Jerry, and resubmit the meeting dates?
Yes. In fact, we will send. If you adopt it, we will send an Outlook invitation to everybody for each of the meetings.
Awesome. Can we have a motion to approve the 2024 board and committee meeting dates with the reflecting the change for July 2024. I will make that motion. Do I have a second?
4 seconds.
Thank you, Deborah. Any objection? Not hearing any, and motion passes to approve the board and committee meeting dates for 2024. Moving on to item 5, the medical reports. Letter A, all duty and ordinary disability applications and reexaminations for November 2023. Go ahead, Jerry.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first report is for the medical panel. It's pretty much routine reexaminations. The medical panel is recommending approval for all the reexaminations this month. The second report is the medical council. We've got two new applications on this report. Craig Meyer is with the DPW, and he's applying for ordinary, and that's been recommended for approval. And then Christopher Sardinia also applying for this one's for duty. It's a new application, and they're recommending approval. The third report has to do with denials, and this is just a denial of Mr. Sardinia's ordinary application because he was approved for duty. So if we have a motion to approve the re-exams and the new applications that were recommended for approval, that would be appreciated.
Mr. Chair, I'll make that motion.
Thank you, Ms. King, and I will second the motion to approve medical reports for November 2023. Any objections regarding? Not hearing any objections, motion to approve medical reports for November passes. Moving on to item 6, unfinished business. Letter A, pending legal opinions and service requests report. I believe that's Patrick.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing I'll note is to reiterate that I will distribute the joint and survivor benefits factors legal opinion as soon as the finalized copy of that is available. So the board members can expect to receive that by email, possibly today, but certainly at some point this week.
Excellent. Thank you, Patrick. Any other comments? Not hearing any, we'll move on to item six, letter B, pending legislation report.
There's nothing new really to report there, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Jerry. Any comments or questions from members? Not hearing any, we'll move on to item 6, letter C, executive director's report, inventory of CRS projects. Go ahead, Jerry.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On item number one, personnel update, we're working with DER to fill positions for the fiscal services assistant and investment analyst senior position. There may be other positions that open up as a result of the fiscal services assistant opening vacancy. It sometimes works that way. People get promoted and then there's additional vacancies that occur, which is probably a healthy thing for internal promotion. Member services. Item number two, we had a number of new retirees in October, 34. We're expecting just over 30 this month. There were some deaths in September, unfortunately, even more than the number that retired, 37 people passed away. We held a workshop, a retirement workshop for the police department folks on the 13th, and we had good attendance. There was 28 attended. Mike was there. To provide information for people who are approaching retirement. The last workshop for the year will be on Friday the 11th. It actually was already, and this was mostly for the general city people. Mike Juke also attended the Milwaukee Retired Police Association meeting to give them an update on any changes to retiree health insurance for next year, and also to reassure some folks about the change over to the Wisconsin retirement system. It's only for new hires. It doesn't affect any existing annuitants. And so I think that was a great comfort to everybody. And of course, we did have representatives at the open enrollment fairs. Mike and his team was there. I stopped by to meet with a few people. So that's now been concluded, I guess, at the end of the period, for re-enrollment in benefit plans for the city. Moving down to financial services, Daniel met with the folks from the Wisconsin Legislative Audit Bureau to work on the 2023 financial audit. And we talked about the Baker Tilly contract earlier in the meeting, so that was approved for Baker Tilly be indemnified so they would be agreed to release their work papers. And Mr. Silber also met with the LAB folks to discuss their investment policies and procedures. So these are the beginnings of the audit. And of course, as the year concludes and we get information from our custodian, we'll be transferring more additional information to the LAB so that they can process the audit. DER has recently implemented the market studies they were doing for our employees and reclassifications, and those some of those studies resulted in increases for our people. There are some additional studies that are going to be reported to the Civil Service Commission here in December, and we're looking forward to participating in that process, and we'll keep the board informed as to what's occurring. Those studies that are going to be coming up in December are for the IT staff, and we're very much interested in the outcome of those. Also, DER started implementing what they refer to as matrix placements for ERS positions that had their positions market study and reclassified, and this provides for additional pay increases for people that have up to 10 years of service to get an additional increase. And so that's an interesting idea. The first time this has been implemented by the city in just this way. And of course, we're going to be working with our employees and DER to explain that practice. We got a full report this month from Financial Services. We started training and enrolling employees to join the WRS after 12/31. In other words, our in-house people that are working on this process are training to be ready to perform their function with respect to enrollment in the WRS. And I know that Terry's been working with ITMD across the street to, you know, get the reporting up and running. The first reports, I guess, don't really go out until February, right, Terry? Yeah, for the month of January. So that process is well underway, and I'm happy to report that it's, so far everything is green. We don't anticipate any delays there. We've been working with U.S. Bank as our new banking vendor. We have accounts set up so far, and we've been working with their representative and our relationship manager to keep us on track to switch over in January. We've got to make over the switch over for the January payroll, and everything seems to be a go there as well. And the city has issued an RFP for a new enterprise reporting system to replace its PeopleSoft payroll personnel system. And we've been reviewing, we've had, I believe Terry's been on the team to review the vendor demos in connection with that. So we're providing some assistance to the city for that process. And then on administration, we talked today about the survivorship factors, the new actuarial tables, and I won't go into that any further. But they will be taking effect, as Mr. Helling asked about, April 1st for members of our system who elect to retire on or after April 1st. And that is my report for the month. I would like to say one more thing about the question Mr. Helling had earlier about the police officer who passed away. Actually, he was killed in the line of duty. So he was a line of duty death. There's no question about that. But he didn't have any beneficiaries to receive, or any survivors to receive that benefit. So he was paid the ordinary instead. That's what the charter provides for. But the officer was definitely a line of duty death, to clarify that situation. Okay, so that's my report. And if anybody has any questions now or later, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you, Jerry. Any comments or questions regarding?
Questman has just two quick ones.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Jerry, regarding 3D with the new enrollment starting first of the year.
Yes.
So just because I get asked from people, so the WRS does some pretty nice webinars, and they have some, you know, watch anytime information on how their plan operates on their website. But when city employees retire, they're still going to go through our office for their processing. Is that right? They go to somebody from Madison.
So first of all, let's remember we're talking about people that are going to first be hired after the first of the year, and most of their retirements will be decades in the future, right? There may be some. Okay. There may be some older folks that are hired right away in January, and potentially, you know, they could be retiring, I guess, in, you know, 5 to 10 years. But basically, when a person who's in the WRS retires, as you mentioned, the WRS provides information and counseling. I know because my wife was a school teacher and she went through that process. I went to Madison with her and attended one of their excellent meetings. So those folks will be getting their information from the WRS. They are, in fact, the subject matter experts. We will, for our part, since we're local, we will put on our website links to the WRS so that people can find it, you know, handy to find their way into the WRS. And of course, anybody hired after the first year will begin probably to receive, you know, throughout their tenure, information about the Wisconsin retirement system. We have some coordinators here, you know, at ERS, who the WRS agents, as they're called, who will be providing, facilitating a communication between the WRS and the City of Milwaukee employees. So we will be passing through any information that is made available to the City of Milwaukee as an employer regarding its employees and their participation in the WRS. So we will be performing that function. It's not clear at this point, you know, how much that will be, because we haven't done it before, but we will be engaged in that process, and of course we will direct people to the WRS folks in Madison. They do a great job, and they are the subject matter experts. Their plan is has a number of options that ours doesn't, and I can tell you that from personal experience, having worked through it with my wife. And it would behoove everybody to go to a group or individual counseling session. Most of them there are group sessions, you know, small groups, and because there are different retirement options available that we don't have here, some of which are pretty interesting, actually. So I would always recommend people to, you know, get it straight from the folks in Madison, because they are the experts. Thank you. Hope that answers your question, Tom.
Yeah, good. I wasn't thinking that we're not going to get any regular service retirements, but we are going to get people that get hired and then quit or transfer and ask about their transferability for a job offer in another city or something. So that's what my thought was.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't understand that aspect of it.
Yeah, yes, that was my bad wording. Yeah. Yeah.
So yes, there is you know, city state reciprocity. That's reciprocity. Well, reciprocity isn't probably exactly the right word, but there are dual benefit systems that have, each one provides its own benefit for people if they retire within 60 days, apply for retirement within 60 days for both systems. And of course, we coordinate that on our end, and the WRS folks coordinate on their end. We've been through that process many times. It's fairly complicated, so it would behoove people to come in actually will have to come in and get counseled by our counselors in order to apply for our benefit. And just to give people just a general idea of how it works, Tom, people who have participated in both systems will have two benefits. They'll get benefit A and benefit B. One will be ERS and one will be the WRS. And if they worked here first, which is likely to be the case for many, many years, then their final average salary will be indexed for inflation under the provisions of our plan and the reciprocity agreements with WRS, so that they'll get our benefit, you know, based on what they earned here, plus their salary will be indexed in the event that they go to work for the state. They'll then get the state benefit as well. That's a kind of a simplification, but that's kind of how it works.
Okay, great, thanks. And regarding our earlier approval of the new, more survivorship factors, I meant to ask if you're going to, is there a window in that when this is going to get implemented, now that we've approved them, when do these go into effect?
April 1st, as Mr. Helling was asking about, April 1st, this will take effect, and we will notify people. Our plan is to actually send a letter to all the people who are currently eligible to retire on or before April 1st And that includes all the city people as well as the agencies, people in MPS, for example, will get a letter from us as well. And we will advise them that, you know, these factors are taking in effect in April and that they are invited to come in and get counseling. I don't think we're going to try to explain much about the details of the factors in the letter because it's pretty complicated. It's better that they get it face-to-face so that they understand what their benefit will be if they retire before April 1st or after April 1st. But there will be this, as you, I think, called it a window of opportunity for people to be informed about the change so that they can make an informed decision.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Jerry. Thank you. Any other comments for Jerry? Questions? All right, we'll move on to item 7, informational. There is item A through J. If there's no comments or questions regarding, we will place those on file. Any comments regarding those? Not hearing any, I will entertain a motion to conclude the meeting.
I want to make the motion.
Aicha will second.
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you, Aicha. Any objections?
No.
Not hearing any. That concludes the meeting for today. It is 11:37 a.m. Everyone have a good day.